doesn't Bernie deserve this? I mean, he has proved. I mean, he was, what, 30 points behind in Iowa? He has proved, I think, at this point, that this is a year when anything can happen. I heard a lot about Donald Trump will never, Donald Trump will never. And then Donald Trump did everything they said he would never do. I think the rules are out the window until proven otherwise. Now, we may revert back to politics as usual. But until we do, doesn't Bernie deserve the people who have been saying, oh, I like Bernie, but he can't be elected, to shut up? The Bernie butters.
Whoa, wait.
Hasn't he earned that much?
No candidate has higher negatives than Donald J. Trump. And he is the apparent frontrunner for the Republican nomination. But the person in this election season that has the second highest negatives is Hillary Clinton. If they went up against each other in the fall, it would be the most hated politician versus the second most hated politician. And I pointed out a couple of shows ago, and it got us some attention from Dan Savage. And I told you I was going to talk about that. And I was going to pull clips from the Savage Lovecast. And I decided instead not to do that. Wait, that's not true. I did pull one because it was very, very sweet. I have a great degree of respect for Dan Savage and have for a while. But in my mind, Dan Savage, he largely gives love and sex advice. Yes, he does get into politics. But when I think Dan Savage, I think about those witty articles that I would read, especially when I lived in Seattle during the early aughts in the late 90s, called Savage Love.
The Fire You Can't Put Out podcast.
Yeah, okay, there we go. That's all I pulled from his show, was when he said the name of my show, because, yay, I do have a great deal of respect for him. Now, keeping in mind that, yes, he was the guy that made the word Santorum what it is. If you don't know what I'm talking about, Google Santorum. So, yes, clearly he's politically active. So on his show, he mentioned our show and he talked about how I was in the tank for Bernie Sanders. Yes, I am in the tank for Bernie Sanders. And with good reason. I've got a lot of issues with Hillary Clinton. That said, I have maintained that I'm going to vote for her in the fall if Bernie does not get the nomination. But up until that point, I am going to fight like hell for Bernie Sanders.
We'll absolutely admit that Secretary Clinton has the support of far more governors, mayors, members of the House. She has the entire establishment, or almost the entire establishment, behind them. That's a fact. I don't deny it. But I am pretty proud that we have over 1 million people who have contributed to our campaign, averaging $27 a piece, that we have had meetings where 25,000-30,000 people have come out, that our campaign is a campaign of the people, by the people, and for the people. So, Rachel, yes, Secretary Clinton does represent the establishment.
I can't emphasize enough how important this particular meme is with respect to this election. It is going to be the people versus the establishment. As much as they would like you to believe over on the GOP side that Cruz does not represent the establishment, he does. Because the establishment represents its donors, and Cruz represents its donors. But Donald Trump isn't being bought off. No, Donald Trump also represents that same faction. He represents the donor class. You can't tell me that if a billionaire, a conservative billionaire, is elected president, you can't tell me that he's not going to represent them. And then there's Hillary Clinton. Is Hillary Clinton a progressive? Yes. Would Hillary Clinton be better than the conservative candidates? Yes. But there's a reason why she is not our first choice. There's an issue with delegates right now. The first issue is she's getting an awful lot of them. I have a bit of an issue with one of our local progressive commentators. Another person whom I disagree with, but I also have great respect for. His name is Carl Wolfson. I listened to Wolfson when he was on KPOJ after I moved to Portland and very much enjoyed his show. And then when KPOJ was flipped to a sports station, eventually he made his way over to X-Ray. And then I would listen to him on X-Ray. But recently he quit his X-Ray show. And he said the reason he quit his X-Ray show is because of what are being referred to as the Bernie Bros. And I pointed out to him, you know, if you are in talk radio, if you're in political talk radio, you don't get to have a thin skin, because this political talk radio is a battlefield. I've heard every talker that I listen to, just about every talker I listen to, whether conservative or liberal, talk about how it gets so nasty inside their email and inside their social media feed that they get death threats. And I'm aware of that. And I'm very happy to be in this field. I'm very happy to be in this arena. Yes, yes. I at times can have a thin skin, but I understand with politics, this is just the name of the game. And he has been on an absolute tear against Bernie Sanders as of late. And he's been taken to the woodshed by his listeners and former listeners. And yes, there are a lot of former listeners to Carl Wolfson because he's in the tank for Hillary Clinton. And it's okay. It's the primary. Pick who you want. But his issue with Bernie Sanders, and by the way, this is a guy who used to work with Tom Hartman. His issue with Bernie Sanders is that he is unelectable. All the people, the tens of thousands of people that have shown up to his rallies prove that he is unelectable. The fact that violence is not breaking out at his rallies, he's unelectable. The fact that he's touching millions of people's lives with his message, which is not communism, which is not socialism, as it's being told to us, makes him unelectable. I don't think either one of the Democratic candidates are unelectable. But the reason that we're making the choice that we're making in this election is because Bernie is speaking to us in a way that nobody has spoken to us before, saying things that the establishment will not say. And I don't believe that anybody has pointed this out. Bernie is a middle-class guy, not a millionaire, not a billionaire. His net worth is less than $1 million. And most of his net worth is tied up in the value of his home, as it is with most of us middle-class folks. Look, we got a middle-class guy that is getting the kind of traction that he's getting. And then folks are saying, nope, he's unelectable. He's middle-class like the rest of us. He's electable. Let's get to the delegates. She's got a lot of delegates, but then there's another thing called superdelegates. The superdelegates are the most anti-democratic part of the Democratic Party. The superdelegates were added to the nomination process as a reaction to the chaotic 1980 Democratic Convention in which supporters of Ted Kennedy attempted to challenge President Jimmy Carter. Yes, Ted Kennedy primary Jimmy Carter. The goal was to give party elites more control. In 2008, the superdelegates, like they are now, flocked to Clinton over Obama. And it created the same kind of controversy that we're seeing now, which is subverting the democratic process. And to make matters worse, we now have a thing with the superdelegates where they are also lobbyists.
Instead of standing up to that finance system, Secretary Clinton has a super PAC, which is raising huge amounts of, I hate to say the word huge, every time I say huge, it means a lot of money from Wall Street.
Lee Fong is one of the finest investigative journalists in the country right now, and I read a ton of his work. He writes for The Intercept mainly now, and he points out that lobbyist superdelegates are tipping the nomination toward Hillary Clinton. Lobbyists are not only, quoting here, lobbyists are not only staffing and financing, they're staffing and financing her presidential campaign. Remember, Bernie Sanders won the Democratic primary by more than 22 percentage points, and by doing so, earned 15 delegates to Clinton's 9. So, it came as an absolute shock to a lot of observers when Clinton, despite losing the second biggest rout in state history, walked away with the same number of delegates. That's because Clinton had the support of 6 New Hampshire unpledged delegates, better known as superdelegates, consisting of prominent elected officials and members of the DNC, that's the Democratic National Committee, who have the same power as delegates chosen by the voters. There are 712 superdelegates in all, which is about 15% of the total delegates available, and 30% of the total needed to win the nomination. If the nomination process is closed, superdelegates may effectively pick the party's presidential nominee, potentially overriding the will of the voters. But here's the problem. These individuals, who I'm about to name, are unelected Clinton-supporting superdelegates who simultaneously work for the lobbying industry. Jeff Berman, well known for his delegate strategy work in the past, is being paid by the Hillary Clinton campaign to organize her delegate counting effort while himself being a superdelegate. He's counting them, and he's also a superdelegate. A top lobbyist at Brian Cave LLP, Berman previously worked as a lobbyist for the private prison company Geo Group, which we've also talked about on this program, as a lobbyist and as a lobbyist helping TransCanada build support for the Keystone XL pipeline, which I understand she has now come out against, but it doesn't matter. This guy is now working for her, and he's a superdelegate supporting her. Bill Shaheen, who is the husband of Senator Jean Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire, is also one of the six New Hampshire delegates, superdelegates, to endorse Clinton. He is a prolific party fundraiser, and his law firm is registered to lobby local efforts in the state. The most recently available lobbying records show that his firm is registered to lobby on behalf of the American Council of Life Insurers and Pain Care Centers, among others. Pain Care has faced increasing scrutiny as local officials have noted that 8 of the 10 most prolific opioid prescribers in New Hampshire's Medicaid program worked for Pain Care. The flood of prescription painkillers has fueled the heroin epidemic in the region, as 4 out of 5 heroin addicts support beginning their drug habit with opioids. Joanne Dowdle, another New Hampshire superdelegate who is also senior vice president for Global Government Affairs at News Corp. You know the name News Corp. That's the parent company of Fox News. Superdelegates, this will blow your mind. Jill Alper, Minion Moore, and Maria Cardona are officials at Dewey Square Group, a lobbying firm that is closely affiliated with the Clinton campaign and retained by the Clinton-supporting super PACs Priorities USA, Action, and Correct the Record. Dewey Square Group was retained by the health insurance industry to undermine health reform efforts in 2009, including proposals to change Medicare Advantage. The firm has previously worked to influence on behalf of Enron, Countrywide, Citigroup, Coca-Cola, and the U.S. Telecom Association and News Corporation. Jennifer Cunningham is the managing director of SKD Knickerbocker, a political consulting firm. In recent years, SKD Knickerbocker helped a coalition of corporate clients lobby the Obama administration on a tax cut for overseas earnings, lobbied for weakening rules governing for-profit colleges, and helped a food industry group undermine Michelle Obama's nutrition guidelines for foods marketed to children. Tonio Bergeau, a fundraiser for Clinton, is a lobbyist registered to influence New York City officials. Bergeau current client list includes Verizon, Pfizer, and American Airlines. And then Emily Gisk, also a lobbyist in New York City, registered to work on behalf of Airbnb and Yum Brands. That's the parent company of Taco Bell. Pfizer again, and the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association, a trade group for Wall Street firms such as Goldman Sachs, Fidelity, and Bank of America. And remember, in recent months, the DNC has quietly repealed rules instituted by Barack Obama that banned lobbyists from donating to the party. Now, MoveOn.org has sponsored a petition for calling for the DNC to not allow superdelegates to deny democracy. They would like to get rid of the whole superdelegate process altogether, as would a lot of Democrats. And this is why it is so important that Hillary Clinton release the transcripts.
Earlier tonight, I asked Senator Sanders, will you give your transcripts of speeches? That's what you said. When the others give, then I'll give. Right. He said he doesn't have the bank speeches. If he can find any of the speeches that he did give for money, he will gladly give the transcripts up. So, will you agree to release these transcripts? They have become an issue.
Sure, if everybody does it, and that includes the Republicans.
If everybody does it, and that includes the Republicans, and this is why it's a problem. You are not running against the Republicans right now. You are running against the Democrat. And, by the way, we don't need the Republicans to release theirs. We know what they said. They went to Wall Street and they said, we're going to give you every damn thing that you want. The only person you need to be worried about is Bernie Sanders.
But you've done speeches that were paid before. Why don't you go first, say, here are my transcripts.
If
Secretary Clinton...
That's not a problem. And I have not had a paid speech. It's against the law to give paid speeches. I have given some speeches. The money was donated to charity way, way back. I got a few dollars. If I can find the transcripts, I'm very, very happy to do it. But what Secretary Clinton said, I will do it if other people do it. Well, I am very happy to release all of my paid speeches to Wall Street. Here it is, Chris. There ain't none. I don't do that. I don't get I don't get speaker's fees from Goldman Sachs. It's not there. So I'm happy to do my best in releasing any of the speeches. Won't be very shocking to anybody.
You're running against Bernie Sanders. And right now, you should release those transcripts. Because, yes, this is a concern. Because, A, okay, I understand that as a senator from New York, you had to represent Wall Street. That's just part of it. But you don't have to represent them so much more than you represent regular people. But you are. And you have. And you've got them working for your campaign. Some of them are now superdelegates. And some of them are already thinking about the jobs that they would like to do if you become president. I've said that the issue with Hillary Clinton, for a lot of people, I believe, is a little bit sexist. Please, allow me to finish. A little bit. Not entirely. A little bit. Because the hatred that is behind her, not just from the left, but from the right, is so white hot. It can't possibly be justified with simply who she is. Now, I read a lot leading up to this show, and the more and more I read about how much Wall Street is helping Hillary Clinton, the more and more mad that I got. But while I was reading these articles for this show, I said that there is no way that anybody has heard of Jeff Berman or Joanne Dowdle or Bill Shaheen or Jill Alper or Mignon Moore, Maria Cardona, or Larry Fink. Larry Fink is a guy who was the head of a team called BlackRock. Now, this also from The Intercept, this time by David Dayen. BlackRock is far from a household name, but it is the largest asset management firm in the world, controlling $4.6 trillion in investment funds, about $1 trillion more than the annual federal budget, and five times the assets of Goldman Sachs. And Larry Fink, BlackRock CEO, has assembled a veritable shadow government full of former Treasury Department officials at his company. Fink has made it clear that he wants to become Treasury Secretary someday. The Obama administration did have him on the short list to replace Timothy Geithner. When that did not materialize, he pulled several members of prior Treasury departments into high-level positions at the firm, which may improve the prospects of realizing his dream in a future Clinton administration. And his priorities appear to be in sync with so much with Clinton's that it's not entirely clear who shares whose agenda. Clinton, for her part, has refused to rule out a Treasury secretary drawn from Wall Street. And this is why it's so important for her to release those transcripts and be more transparent. Christopher Meade now works at BlackRock, used to work for the Treasury Department. Katherine Roseman used to work for the Treasury Department, now works as a managing director at BlackRock and is also an advisor to the Clinton campaign. Kendrick Wilson, Michael Pyle, all of these people used to work for the Treasury Department and now work for Larry Fink because he really, really wants to be Treasury Secretary. Michael Pyle was a senior advisor to Lael Brainard when she served as Undersecretary to the Treasury for International Affairs and also worked at the White House for National Economic Council and the Office of Management and Budget. Also worked as a director at BlackRock until 2015 when he apparently is now an economic advisor to the Clinton campaign. Fink's most telling hire, though, has to be Cheryl Mills, arguably Clinton's most trusted confident. She was Clinton's chief of staff at the State Department, was deputy White House counsel in the Bill Clinton administration, and is on the board of directors for the Clinton Foundation. Fink hired Mills for the BlackRock board of directors in October 2013 in what observers muse was a ploy to insinuate himself into the Clinton inner circle. Fink, and this is important, and this is why Fink is a problem, also opposes efforts to reinstitute Glass-Steagall, which is the firewall between investment and commercial banks. And so far up to this point, it seems that Clinton does too. In fact, his views on Wall Street are so similar to Clinton's that it's hard to see it as a coincidence. Most notably, Clinton's financial reform plan is mute when it comes to regulating asset management firms such as SIFIs. Okay, I know this stuff, and I know this stuff now, and I know this stuff especially because I specifically went out seeking this particular information. But does the average person who does not like Mrs. Clinton know these same things? That's why I have to say that at least a little bit of it has to come from sexism or some of the unfair attacks that have been thrown at her by the folks at Fox who really blame her for everything. If it's not her, it's Obama. But something pretty telling happened recently. We know that they're, by and large, in the establishment, pretty unhappy with their nominee for the GOP. Nobody likes Ted Cruz, and nobody likes Donald Trump. So Ben Stein appeared recently on the TV machine, and he was asked who he might support.
You know, I just wonder, who are you supporting this time around? Obviously, it's not Donald Trump, but who is it?
Well, I don't know. I went to law school with Mrs. Clinton, so I've always had a kind of fondness for her. She was always a very nice young woman, and we were all young in those days. And so I kind of liked her. I admire the fact that Bernie Sanders has a single-payer national health plan. When I worked for Mr. Nixon as a speechwriter, I wrote the message that sent up Mr. Nixon's proposal for single-payer health plan. But I would like to see it be a Republican. I've never voted for a Democrat. But Mr. Trump, I think, is dangerously misinformed. I like him, but he's dangerously misinformed.
Hillary Clinton was the first name that came out of his mouth. And he likes Mrs. Clinton. Went to school with Mrs. Clinton. Wait a minute. You're not supposed to like Mrs. Clinton. You're Ben Stein. Bernie being in the campaign has helped bring Hillary more to the left. And I remember hearing Senator Sanders say that he was going to jump in the race. And one of the things that he prefaced it with was, I don't wake up every day wanting to be president. He says, but if nobody progressive enough gets in the race, and I'm doing this from memory here, so this isn't a quote, he says, then I will put my name in to run for president. And when it looked like Hillary was the presumptive front runner, or going to be that front runner, he threw his name in. And yes, it is true. She's Democrat, but she's really not that progressive. But the more and more that Bernie's in the race, and even if Bernie doesn't get the nomination, this is why it's very important that he's in the race, because he is building a coalition, and the political revolution that he wants is very, very possible.
What I have said is that this campaign is not just about electing a president. It is about making a political revolution.
And even if he doesn't get the nomination, he will still be a very, very powerful senator with an awful lot of people behind him. And when Barack Obama put together OFA, he eventually let OFA die. He put together OFA, he got elected, and then he said, okay, that's all right, you can go home. I've got it from here. But Bernie Sanders will not do that. Bernie Sanders will use the coalition that he has built because the work is more important. It isn't about him becoming president. It's about changing the country and changing it for the better. Gee, I sound like him now. But I understand what it is. It's not about him for Trump. It's completely about Trump. Making Trump president is just about making Trump president, and that's it. But the suggestion that the only reason that he's in the race, the only reason he is in the race, is to move Hillary Clinton to the left, has got to be one of my biggest pet peeves from this election cycle.
Do you think ultimately one of your goals may be to push Hillary Clinton a little more to the left, to push her in a more progressive direction on a number of issues?
No.
No.
My goal is to win this election.
Would you be interested in being her vice president?
Would she be interested in being my vice president?
Oh, so gangsta. Oh, would I like to be her vice president? Would she like to be my vice president? And I love the fact that he whispered. You could just hear the contempt. He's sick of hearing this. He's not here to move her to the left. And by the way, she's running for the Democratic nomination. He shouldn't have to move her to the left. Chris Matthews' wife is running for Congress. And Chris Matthews works for MSNBC. Chris Matthews is also a Hillary backer. He won't say it out loud, but he is. And his wife is friends with Hillary Clinton. This is one of the things that is not disclosed when Bernie Sanders goes on with Chris Matthews. Now, by the way, I like Chris. I've watched or listened to his show for years, and I really like listening to his analysis. But this time around, this election cycle, he's gotten under my skin a few times because of how contentious he is with Bernie, but he's not with her. And by the way, he insists on calling Bernie Sanders a socialist, which he is not. That's what these dumb-dumbs on the right are calling him, a socialist and a communist. And no, he's not a socialist. He's a Democratic socialist. So, but Bernie Sanders is a good sport and decided to go on Chris Matthews' show. Chris Matthews just had a hell of a whooping to unleash on Senator Sanders.
You're missing the point, all right? You're missing the point. If you look at politics today as a zero-sum total,
right.
If you're looking at 63% of the American people not voting, 80% of young people not voting, billionaires buying elections, right. You're right. I'm not looking at that world.
How's that going to change the day you're in office? You won't have a Supreme Court on your side.
What I will have is millions of people demanding...
You need 60 votes to get a Supreme Court nominee. Well, no, we're starting at the very point of can you do what you say you're going to do?
Yes, damn right, I can do what I say.
How are you going to do it? What have you done? Have you ever done anything like this? Have you ever gotten 60 votes? Have you ever gotten 60 votes for anything in the Senate?
Yeah, actually, we have.
What was it?
My veterans bill, comprehensive veterans bill, the strongest veterans bill passed in many, many years. But that's as a senator. Now I am... hopefully the president of the United States. We have the bully puppet.
One of the most annoying things is when people say, how are you going to get anything done? Hey, Clinton couldn't get anything. Obama couldn't get anything. How are you going to get anything? You're a socialist. How are you going to get anything? How are we going to get anything? Oh, because Bernie Sanders is going to have long coattails if he gets to go into the general election. Because he's speaking the language that a lot of people want to hear because he's speaking out against economic inequality. But you hear Mr. Matthews just ripping into him. But here, if you're having trouble understanding exactly how this is going to work, if Bernie Sanders becomes president, follow me. Follow me and follow Killer Mike.
How will Sanders pass legislation in Republican Congress? We are going to vote out Republicans. You, on the other side of that camera, will go back to the polls, unlike what you did with Obama. We didn't go back out and vote. Voting is not a one-time act and a wizard saves everything. Take your butt out and vote every single election. That's how we do it.
Killer Mike
has just been a ton of fun in this election. As a big hip-hop head, it's been nice to hear Killer Mike get behind something. It's not as though rappers don't get involved in politics, but Young Jeezy got involved in politics back in the 2008 election and initially got behind McCain, and a hell of a lot of people came out against Young Jeezy, who eventually backed Senator Obama at that time and even released the song My President is Black to say, yes, I am here. But what Killer Mike is doing is much different. And he's campaigning in a huge way, and he understands that there's also an issue with African-American voters who aren't getting behind Bernie Sanders in quite the way they're getting behind Hillary Clinton. But he's on the campaign trail working really hard for him. So, continuing with the Chris Matthews thing, sorry, I got off the rails there for a moment. Even with as combative as Matthews was being, Senator Sanders continued to drive the point home. And the same point that he has been trying to drive home for his entire career.
What I am trying to do is not just pass legislation. I'm trying to change the face of American politics.
And that's the point. We're trying to change the way that we do things. Another one of the things that has been brought up with some frequency is tax rates. How tax rates would go up under Bernie Sanders. And yes, they would. Not necessarily on the rest of us, but it certainly would on the wealthy. But oh, Melvin, they can't afford it. They're so freaking rich, they can't afford to raise their taxes. If you raise their taxes, they won't create any more jobs for us. They don't create any more jobs for us. We won't be able to buy clothes and food and cars. Easy now. What the wealthy, so-called job creators, don't want you to know is that they need us more than we need them. And by the way, they also need us to get out and vote for oligarch politicians so that they can continue having the gigantic chunk of wealth that they have. Bernie Sanders, that socialist, he wants to raise our taxes. Okay, the top marginal tax rate, and by the way, we've got a progressive tax structure. The top marginal tax rate might go to 60%.
Damn that socialist!
It might go to 60%, maybe 65%, but that's not the highest that it's ever been. The highest that it's ever been is under Republican, socialist, Nazi, blah, 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 Eisenhower. Republican President Eisenhower. The top marginal tax rate was 91%, and we had unprecedented growth. Now, by the way, this doesn't mean that everybody's going to pay 91% for a tax rate, which is what they don't understand over on Fox News.
I'm fleeing. If Bernie Sanders gets elected president, I'm fleeing. I'm going to Ireland, and they already know it. So that's, I shouldn't say it publicly,
because
that'll get Sanders more votes. But I'm not going to pay 90% of my income to that guy. I'm sorry. I'm not doing it.
That right there is the best reason to vote for Bernie Sanders as president. I would love to see Jackboot Bill get the hell out of the country. Now, he mentioned, I'm going to Ireland. You know what Ireland has? Gay rights. You know what else Ireland has? High taxes. You know what else Ireland has? A universal healthcare system. Are you sure you want to go to Ireland there, Mr. O'Reilly? I understand you're not thinking. You're just throwing things out there. And he pointed out, he goes, oh man, I don't know if I should have said that because he becomes president. I might really have to leave the country now. Please, please. If nothing else, let's make Bernie Sanders president just so Bill will get the hell out of the country. Recently at a debate, and this according to an article over at BuzzFlash, Sanders was asked at the debate how high he might raise the top marginal tax rate on the upper bracket Americans. His response was, we haven't come up with an exact number yet, but it will not be as high as it was under Dwight D. Eisenhower, which he said it was 90%, but it was 91%. Also from BuzzFeed, to today's oligarchy, taxing the rich at above the 90% marginal rate is akin to Lenin setting U.S. government policy, which is why many of the richest people in the nation are sneering to Bernie Sanders in response to Bernie Sanders' democratic socialism, which, by the way, actually preserves capitalism. And here's what they say. He wants socialism. And this is my problem with Matthews when he says he's a socialist. He's a democratic socialist. And by the way, democratic socialism actually preserves capitalism. Would you like to know how? Bear with me. If you look at the three Scandinavian nations, okay, and this is where we always look. We look to the Scandinavian nations because they have all of the things or most of the things that their people need. They've got very low inequality. They've got great health rates. And for the happiness index, they're always in the top 10. Sweden, Norway, Denmark. Sanders refers to these models for his particular vision of democratic socialism, which is not by any means a comprehensive state-run ownership of production or property. One of the other things Matthews tried to point out, and this is why MSNBC is not liberal. One of the other things he tried to point out is, well, he hasn't mentioned taking over industry yet. No, he hasn't because he's not going to, okay? These countries are not socialist. They are capitalist. Capitalist nations with a strong social safety net. The Scandinavian governments might provide everything from health services to free college tuition to livable pensions, with variations among them, but their economies are not socialist. They're strongly capitalist and particularly prosperous. According to the pro-corporate think tank, the Tax Foundation, Denmark's top marginal effective tax rate is 60.4%. Sweden's is 56.4%. Norway's top marginal tax rate is 39%. But in America, the highest, and by the way, damn near nobody pays this, is 39.6%. In fact, the business-friendly tax foundation concedes that the Scandinavian nations are more tax-friendly to corporations than the U.S. Quote, while Scandinavian countries raise a lot of revenue from individuals through the income tax, payroll taxes, and value-added tax, they don't really raise much more revenue than the United States from capital and business taxes and don't have much higher marginal rates on capital income. Marginal corporate tax rates in Scandinavian countries are around the, for OECD countries, I use this term all the time, OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperational and Development, average 25% and are much more competitive than the United States rate. Denmark's corporate income tax rate is 24.5%. Norway's general corporate income tax rate is 27%. And Sweden has an corporate tax rate of 22%. The U.S. marginal tax rate on corporations is much higher at 39.1%. Now remember, those are supposedly socialist countries that are killing business. It might also be worthy to note that the Scandinavian countries spend much less of their national budgets percentage-wise than does the U.S. on military. This allows them to put their funds in things that benefit their citizens. And this is one of the things I pointed out, that the largest thing, the thing that we spend the most amount of money on, yeah, I understand that they're trying to cut welfare. What the hell is that? Less than 1% of the budget, and they go, if we cut that, it'll just make everything better. No, it won't. No, it won't, because we're spending 54% of our budget on the military invading countries that we don't need, that we don't get any benefit from. You probably hear paper waving around. Sorry. If one is an advocate of true socialism, The Scandinavian countries are not a good example of such a model. That is because they are economically structured as capitalist nations, although they allocate a greater percentage of the gross domestic product for services than does the U.S. And economic inequality is a very real thing. And more it's been on display at Bernie Sanders rallies. Why? Because Bernie Sanders actually gives a damn about this kind of thing.
I want to hear what it is like if people know people or themselves. What is it like to live on $12,000 or $10,000 a year Social Security? Other thoughts?
I've been living on probably less than that for a long time because of disabilities. It's so hard to do anything to pay your bills. You're ashamed all the time. And I could completely understand how she feels. And when you can't buy presents for your children, it's really, really, really hard. And I worked 3, 4, 5 jobs sometimes, always minimum wage. I have a degree. Divorced, and it's just I'm waiting for disability to come through so my parents have to support me. Let it's me just hard.
All right, thank you. Thank you. And it is not easy for people to stand up and say that. But beyond comprehension, you got Republicans going around saying, we got to cut Social Security. We got to cut it. What people are getting is too much. $10,000 is too much. Does anybody here know what the COLA was, cost of living adjustment this year for people on Social Security? Yeah, Ann knows. It was zero.
And that's the point. Ever since Ronald Reagan became president, conservatives, the Republican Party in this country, has been carefully managing the decline of the middle class. And now it has come to this. Just 62, this according to HuffPo, Emily Peck at HuffPo, 62 ultra-rich individuals, a list that's primarily made up of men that include Bill Gates, Warren Buffett and the Koch brothers, and Walmart heirs, have as much wealth as the bottom half of humanity. 5 years ago, it took 388 rich guys to achieve that status. Now, it is just 62. And that is not a mistake. That is by design. That's the entire point, and that is unsustainable. According to Gawain Kripke, Oxfam's policy director, Oxfam is the one who released this report, while the wealthy might argue that rising wealth is just a fabulous sign of economic prosperity and that you are just jealous, the disproportionate growth at the top is keeping those on the bottom from climbing out of poverty. And there's an entire group of people that are arguing against raising the wages for average people. Kripke also points out that wide inequality is no longer seen as an unfortunate consequence of economic growth. Now, many economists, most famously Thomas Piketty, who was ripped apart by conservatives, contend that inequality actually slows down growth. Remember, they need us more than we need them. As fewer people can afford to buy stuff, and creates economic and political instability. Some of that stability is in the Middle East, where we then what? Just spend a ton of money killing people in the Middle East. There's a wide body of research that shows inequality adversely affects the health of those at the bottom, raising the risk of cardiovascular disease and increasing suicide rates and shortening lifespans. We talked about this on last week's show. Did a whole segment about it. Please refer to it. The richest 1% of the world's population now own half of the world's wealth. Oxfam's report also points a finger to tax dodging and urges governments worldwide to get a handle on tax avoidance and inversion by wealthy individuals and corporations. It's a significant loss to governments, Kripke said. The rich use exotic strategies to park money so that it's inevitable and inaccessible to governments, which could redistribute those dollars to those citizens. He said, we need to reform this. And there it goes. Oh, you want to redistribute my wealth. You want to take the money that I earned from Wall Street, you know, just in stocks and blah. You want to take all the money from my hard work. Shut up. Shut the hell up. You know, that's not, and nobody's buying that crap anymore.
I honestly don't understand how anybody with IQ above plant life would honestly think that we would be better off if we let the government have all of the private property and that the government would dole out what they thought we should have. I'm not feeling the burn, Bill. I'm not feeling it.
In order to make their point, they have to, they absolutely have to mischaracterize the position. They can't tell you what it really is. And by the way, these guys are running for president. And frequently, you'll see people cheering for hearing, when they hear about things like, you know, regular people like you and I will hear about things like lower tax rates, lower tax rates on capital gains, getting rid of what they now call the death tax, right? Which is a tax on inheritance above a certain amount of millions of dollars. And you'll hear regular people cheer for this stuff. Yay, that's going to be so great for all of us. No, it's not. It doesn't trickle down to us. It never has. And it never will. And it's only leading to more income inequality. At the Trump rallies, they've been pretty animated as of late. And when I use the word animated, I'm using that instead of using the word outwardly violent in brown shirts. And recently, Trump threatened he says, the violence at my rallies, that's because of Bernie Sanders. No, it's not. It's because of you. It's because of the language you're using, but it doesn't matter. So he threatens that he's going to start sending some of his people to Bernie's rallies. And remember, they identify with Trump, a guy who has absolutely nothing in common with them, a guy who was born with great wealth, a guy who had great wealth given to him when he was like, I just got a small $1 million loan from my dad. What? What, can't you get a small $1 million loan from your dad? No. Now, most of us regular folks cannot do that. And already, some of these folks are showing up at Bernie's rallies.
Here's a Trump supporter worried about Mr. Trump's money. I say to Mr. Trump and his supporters that the billionaires of this country will not continue to own this nation.
A new study by researchers from Princeton and Northwestern universities finds that America's government policies reflect the wishes of the rich and powerful interest groups. This from Gawker. A study, the U.S. is now an oligarchy, reflects the wishes of the rich and powerful interest groups rather than the wishes of the majority of the citizens. The researchers examined close to 1,800 U.S. policy changes between the years of 81, remember Reagan, and 2002. They compared those policy changes with the expressed preferences of the median American at the 50th percentile of income, with affluent Americans at the 90th percentile of income, and with the position of powerful interest and lobbyist groups. The central point that emerges from our research is that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while mass-based interests and average citizens have little or no independent influence. Our results provide substantial support for theories of economic elite domination and theories of biased pluralism. I'll explain this in a moment. But not for theories of majoritarian electoral democracy or majoritarian pluralism. Please, I understand this is getting wonky. This is great information. Stick with Melvin. Melvin, make it worth your while. The theory of economic elite domination is fairly self-explanatory. However, the theory of biased pluralism holds that policy outcomes tend to tilt towards the wishes of governments and business and professional associations. In essence, the researchers found that government policy changes are correlated with the wishes of the wealthy and with interest groups, but not with the wishes of the average American, even though the whole idea of democracy is to ensure that the wishes of the majority tend to carry the day. The study notes that the position of the median American and the position of the affluent American are often the same. Therefore, regular people tend to think that their political interests are being represented when they see a triumph of some political position that they also happen to agree with. Furthermore, the study found that the positions of powerful interest groups are not substantially correlated with the preferences of average citizens, meaning that the extent of special interest groups have political power, they are driving our government's decision-making process away from the interests of the average American. All mass-based groups taken together simply do not add up in aggregate to good representatives of the citizenry of a whole. Business-orientated groups do even worse, with a modest negative overall correlation. And now a narrative is being created in the media, which, by the way, has been giving non-stop coverage to the Trump train. And has been telling Hillary Clinton that she's the inevitable nominee for the entire time that Barack Obama has been president. And after she won a great deal of southern states that, by the way, will not even be in play for the Democrats in the general election, after she won those, the media has now been trying to tell Bernie that there's no path forward for him.
There are a number of people right now who say the math just doesn't add up for you looking forward. How do you think you can win this nomination?
By getting more delegates. You ready for this one? The answer is by getting more delegates than my opponent. Now, I'm pretty good in arithmetic, and I can add. All right? On Super Tuesday, they're going to be, what is it? Who knows the answer? About 1,000?
80.
You know what? We're going to win a lot of them.
How many? What's your prediction?
Well, I think we're going to win 398.44. How do I know? That's what.
What's your prediction?
You see, this is, let me get back. You know, sometimes I have been known to be critical of the media, right? Once or twice. Here we are talking about children in South Carolina and in America, in the wealthiest country in the world, who have nothing. And you're asking me to predict to you how many votes I'm going to get in 12 states. You know what? I don't know. Nor do you, nor does anybody else. I will tell you the answer to that on Wednesday. How's that?
So this brings me back to my original point. I have a great friend of the show. His name is Mark. I won't use his last name. Don't worry, Mark. I'm not going to make you famous now. He was the guy that pointed out our show to Dan Savage. Eventually, I drew a little bit, in my opinion, I drew a little bit of ire from Mr. Savage, because he pointed out in an op-ed that Democrats can't take yes for an answer. And it would seem that way. And I have said more than a few times, nobody is better at snatching defeat from the jaws of victory than Democrats are. I've said that. And I've gotten in fights with more than a few people who I have a great deal of respect for. One is my friend Justin, who I'm pretty certain he and I were separated at birth. Almost of the same mind. I say almost, because here's where we disagree. He, like quite a few of my other friends, including one that I had on the show a little while ago, they have pointed out to me that they will not vote for Hillary Clinton if she's the nominee. They will not vote for her no matter what. And I want to say, I get it. Although I disagree with you, I get it. Because as I pointed out in that article about the U.S. being an oligarchy, one of the things that makes the country oligarchic is the court system, which could be stalked by these conservatives, and that's my largest concern. Yes, I would be holding my nose to vote for Hillary, but I feel like we need to have, at the very least, the course that we shouldn't just give the whole thing away if we don't get Bernie. Yes, I'm working for Bernie. I'm giving money to Bernie. I'm working incredibly hard for Mr. Sanders, and will, up until the point where it seems like he might not be the nominee. And I've realized that it's not fair of me to go after people who say that they're not going to vote for, that they've decided they're not going to vote for her no matter what. We are in the primary process, and what we should get to do is pick who we want. And we shouldn't be pushed into picking somebody just because. Part of my problem with Mr. Wolfson was he said the reason he is such a serious Hillary backer is because she's electable and Bernie Sanders is not. Don't tell me who is electable. Who's electable is the people, the persons that we are willing to vote for. And it seems to me that there's an awful lot of people willing to vote for one Bernard Sanders. During the primary, you don't get to tell people that they don't get to dream big. You don't get to tell people who they're going to vote for. I disagree with my Bernie or bust people, but I get it, and I support you. Also, I'm fairly certain that that's not the majority. I feel like if I'm able to convince, say, my friend Lee, who is super duper to the left, if I were able to turn his one vote, it wouldn't make a difference. To my other friends that have said that they won't vote for her, there's probably three other people, if I flip their votes, it won't matter. And all I'm doing by getting into fights with these folks is making them not like me and separating us. And what we need to not be doing is separating ourselves right now. There's an article released by The Nation recently, and it says, "Relax, Bernie supporters will back Hillary if she's the nominee." Now, don't get mad at the headline. I understand. I understand why quite a few folks will not. And I support you. I understand you. Quote, "Last week, a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll found that a third of Bernie Sanders supporters are saying that they wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton in November if she's the Democratic nominee, and nearly 60,000 people have signed a Bernie or bust pledge. This is causing plenty of hand-wringing, with one Salon writer writing that Bernie supporters could blow this election. And Huffington Post, a columnist from the Huffington Post, is calling it the Democrats' worst nightmare. But hey, we've seen this before, and we know how it's going to play out. Ironically, in 2008, it was Clinton supporters vowing to stay home or vote for John McCain if Obama became the nominee. At the same time, a HuffPo columnist warned that balkanized Democrats could give the White House to John McCain. That May, primary exit polls found less than half of Hillary Clinton supporters in Indiana and North Carolina saying that they'd consider voting for Obama in the general election. Even in early July, after Obama had secured the nomination, only 54% of Clinton backers said that they planned to vote for him. Those were self-described PUMAs. PUMA. It's an acronym. Party Unity My Ass. Sorry, language, I know. They saying that they would stay home by the dozens in November, but at the end of the day, 9 out of 10 Democrats supported Obama in the election that featured the highest turnout in 40 years. I don't think we're going to see that now. We were in an economic collapse back then. A similar dynamic played out with Howard Dean supporters in 2004. But Howard Dean, by the way, also supporting Hillary Clinton this time around. But Howard Dean is not the good guy he once was. He is now a lobbyist for the health insurance industry. Forgive me. Political scientists call this phenomenon reinforcement effect. It was described in 1940 in the first major study of a presidential campaign. The study's authors noted that voters tended to join the fold to which they belong, with Democrats gravitating toward Franklin D. Roosevelt and Republicans toward Wendell Willkie. These voters were not blindly following whichever shepherds their parties nominated, the study concluded. Rather, their partisan loyalties reflected their underlying values, and the party's nominees solidified their support by emphasizing the same values as the campaign unfolded.
It could be that the inevitable candidate for the Democratic nomination may not be so inevitable today.
And that's a threat, because we are now coming up on the Western states, where folks like myself actually get to have a say in the process. And they say, but in the general election, he can't win Republican voters.
A lot of Republicans like Bernie Sanders.
Actually, he can. And he can because he won a lot of Republican voters in his home state of Vermont. And I understand how white his home state is, but I think that he can get the conservatives. And one of the things from the 2008 campaign that really just rubbed me was, I believe, and I will believe this to the day that I die, was that John McCain picked Sarah Palin because he really thought that he would get the female vote. The female vote that said that they weren't going to vote for Senator Obama. So he gets dum-dum, Sarah Palin, and then she comes in, and he does not get the lady voters. And hey, ladies, if you're worried about Senator Sanders being a feminist, don't worry. He's a feminist.
Good evening, Senator Bernie Sanders. My question is, do you consider yourself a feminist? If so, how do you, as a white male, understand the intersectional identities that people of color face, especially when entering higher positions of power, whether in business or government?
I consider myself a strong feminist. And in fact, Gloria Steinem, everybody knows Gloria, is one of the leading feminists in America, made me an honorary woman many, many years ago. I don't know exactly what that meant, but I accepted it when she came to campaign for me.
So he is middle class, and he is speaking to the issues that mean something to us. And he has also run a high-minded, issues-oriented campaign.
You called Bill Clinton's past transgressions, quote, totally, totally, totally disgraceful and unacceptable. Senator, do you regret saying that?
I was asked a question. You know, one of the things, Andrea, and that question annoys me. I cannot walk down the street, Secretary Clinton knows this, without being told how much I have to attack Secretary Clinton. Want to get me on the front pages of the paper? I make some vicious attack. I have avoided doing that, trying to run an issue-oriented campaign. A question.
You didn't have to answer it that way, though.
Well,
why did you?
Then if I don't answer it, then there's another front page source. Yes. And I mean this seriously. You know that. We've been through this. Yes, his behavior was deplorable. Have I ever once said a word about that issue? No, I have not. I'm going to debate Secretary Clinton, Governor Malley, on the issues facing the American people, not Bill Clinton's personal behavior.
That's Andrea Mitchell, who is another Clinton supporter. According to Quinnipiac right now, and I understand that we're a long way off in the election, but according to Quinnipiac, Bernie would be the strongest candidate for the Democratic Party versus whoever the GOP picks. No matter who they pick, Bernie Sanders beats them and beats them badly. Don't tell me who is and is not electable. And with a lot of those contests, and I understand, like I said, it's early, but Hillary Clinton falls right on the line, which is the margin of error, which we don't know what that would mean for the general election.
A huge role involving a company, the Quinnipiac National Poll. National Poll. Voters back Bernie Sanders over all Republican candidates. That's a head-to-head matchup, a presidential matchup. Head-to-head, Bernie beats the lot. I can't believe
it. Fascinating stuff. Okay, running down the list. Sanders beats Trump 48-42%. Beats Cruz 49-39%. So that's an even bigger margin. He beats Rubio 47%-41%. I'm kind of going a bit ahead here, but I'm excited by Sanders beating Bush 49-39%. The tightest race, ironically, is Sanders over Kasich 45-41%. But bottom line is Bernie wins every matchup against the GOP, no matter who.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it is time to realize that these are the two candidates. Like it or not, for better or for worse, these are the two candidates. And to some degree, yes, they're ideologically aligned. But to another degree, they're not. And yes, I understand, Secretary Clinton, it's a little closer to Wall Street than we would prefer. But we've got two candidates, and they do have a mutual respect for each other. A mutual respect that we, you and I, as Democrats, no matter where we fall on this particular issue, should also have.
If I'm so fortunate as to be the nominee, first person I will call to talk to about where we go and how we get it done will be Senator Sanders.
Senator, would you consider the secretary?
I agree with what the secretary said. We shouldn't be getting ahead of ourselves. And as I have said many times, you know, sometimes in these campaigns, things get a little bit out of hand. I happen to respect the secretary very much. I hope it's mutual. On our worst days, I think it is fair to say we are 100 times better than any Republican candidate.
I fully respect your right to have the hardline stance that you have with respect to her. If you will respect my pragmatic stance with respect to her and understand what the bigger picture here is, and that understand that we are not on separate sides of this issue. We are all Bernie supporters. One of the things that really, really got me in his camp early, many, many years before he even decided to run for president, was the quote that despair is not an option. That meant the world to me.
I know that people are demoralized. Despair is not an option because it's not just for us, but it's for our kids and our grandchildren.
I respect your hardline issue. You respect my pragmatic issue. And I do not believe that you should be bullied into having to vote for somebody that you do not want to vote for. If you want to sit out the election or vote for somebody in the third party, that's absolutely fine. I get it. I understand it. And I will never tell you that you have to vote for Secretary Clinton. Because if you don't, then Trump or Cruz will get in. I understand it now. And I would like to say a special thank you to the friends of mine who inspired this particular episode. I did not plan on prattling on for an entire hour about this, but I wanted to point out some very important things. And yes, thank you to those of you that inspired this episode. You know who you are. All right, on to November, and we have a new home. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. You can download the shows or just stream them there, whatever you want. We set this up over the past weekend. We're working on getting up all the shows eventually. But the new home is tfycpo.podbean.com. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. Listen on the go or download shows from Podbean. Podbean also has an app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or Podbean. Just search for the fire you can't put out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tficpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail. Rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a big thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. And now that I have woken you up, good morning.